ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय
ॐ
नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय differently as dormant, manifest, weak, brilliant, and so on. Okay, what is that about? What's the point there? Huh? Okay, but it's going to come to that point. But what was just said? That fire, What is an example of this? Is this true? That fire may appear differently as dormant, manifest, weak, brilliant, and so on? Have you ever seen fire dormant? If it's dormant, where do you, how is it? What is it?
In wood.
In wood. The fire is there, but it is unmanifest in that sense that it's sleeping. And it could be weak, you're just starting the fire, and it's just starting, and the fire is weak, and sometimes the fire is blazing in wood. Confirmed. So it's setting up, Krishna himself is setting up a metaphor, an analogy for fire. Now, just as fire in wood can be either dormant or weak or brilliant, now what is he going to compare that to? According to the condition of the fuel, because if the fuel is wet, before it can, the fire can burn brilliantly, it has to burn weakly till it dries the water from the wood. So just as fire may appear differently, as dormant, manifest, weak, brilliant, and so on, according to the condition of the fuel, that which it's manifesting from. And fossil fuels, what is the most famous fossil fuel? Petrol, but also wood is coal, yes. Yes. Except gas, we don't usually think of it as a fossil. But what all these fuels do is they store sunlight. Even wood, it takes the sunlight to grow the tree, and it's a storage facility for sunlight, as is every fuel. So the original illumination and heat and fire is coming from the sun. So just as fire may appear differently as dormant, manifest, weak, brilliant, and so on, according to the condition of the fuel, similarly the spirit soul enters a material body, just as fire is in the fuel, and fire manifests differently according to the condition of the fuel. So similarly, a soul which is alive, the soul is the life. It enters the material body and accepts particular bodily characteristics. In other words, it manifests its consciousness, its capacity, according to the body, the condition of the body that it is within. Just as fire manifests either weakly or dormant or brilliantly, depending upon the condition the fuel is in. Okay. In this example, what is the wood compared to? Here is the examination. What is the fuel compared to? In this metaphor. The material body, yes. And what is the fire compared to? The soul. And what, although we haven't heard it yet, what is the differing levels of manifestation of the fire compared to? Yes, yes. The different stages of consciousness. Because if there's a soul practically has unlimited capacity for consciousness. But when it's in the body of a worm, an amoeba, a dragonfly, its ability, its capacity to manifest its consciousness, the actual consciousness of the soul, is compressed and restricted. In human life, when the soul, the same quality of the soul, is within a human body, then it can manifest so much more consciousness. Yes. And then in human life, if we live our life properly, then our consciousness can manifest fully. And then, based on a proper living, which is essentially living in a mode of goodness, then we can achieve full consciousness, which is called Krishna consciousness. Then the soul is manifest in its own natural identity. Does anyone know the verse in the second canto of the Bhagavad Gita, Mukti, that defines liberation? Mukti? Yes? Yeah. Hitva anurupa srupena avastiti. That mukti, the definition of liberation, actual liberation, is the full manifestation of the consciousness into its natural position. And this is what we are longing for, and this is what Krishna consciousness is about. It's about the natural manifestation of the consciousness to its fully expanded position, and that is in relationship with Krishna. So let's hear what the purport is here. Although fire may appear and disappear within a particular object, what's an example of it appearing within a particular object? Fire appearing within a particular object. What's an example of fire appearing within a particular object? What's an example of fire appearing in a particular object? In wood. Thank you very much. Brilliant. You get 100%. Everyone else fails. Yes, in wood. But what's an example of it disappearing in that same object?
Water
is put on it, or somehow it doesn't ignite fully. We've all seen this. That fire can appear in a piece of wood and then it can disappear and it be unmanifest in that same piece of wood. So although fire may appear and disappear within a particular object, the element fire always exists. Similarly, the eternal soul appears within a suitable body and then disappears from that body, but the soul always exists. Just as fire is different from its fuel, the soul is different from the body. A match makes a tiny fire, whereas the explosion of a huge gasoline tank will send flames shooting up into the sky. But still, fire is one. It's fire. Similarly, one spirit soul may appear in the body of Brahma, and another in the body of an ant. But the spirit soul is qualitatively the same in every body. Because of ignorance, we impose the bodily characteristics upon the soul. And thus, we say that a particular person is American, Russian, Chinese, African, or Mexican, or that he is young, old or young. So we're imposing the condition of the body upon the soul. But it's a mental imposition. The soul has nothing to do with the characteristics of the body. Because in the same way, fire is fire. Whether it manifests from this wood or that wood, it's fire. Although such designations certainly apply to the body, they do not apply to the spirit soul, which is described here as para, or a transcendental entity. So the soul is para, it has nothing to do with the body. This is the point. And even though clearly consciousness is manifesting according to the body, consciousness itself and the soul itself has nothing to do with the body. And the proof of this is, it's completely obvious if anyone has ever seen the actual passing of a soul from the body to leaving the body, which we call death. Raise your hand if you've actually seen the moment when soul leaves the body when a person dies. Yeah. It's, what did you see?
Mrs. Karuna Devi Prabhu's father.
You were there. Where? Where was that?
Hospital.
It was in Melbourne. And you were there. And what was it like?
Something changed very drastically.
In a moment. What was the thing that changed? According to what you saw, not. Yeah.
Very lifeless, not very attractive, or didn't have much attraction towards, not much attraction towards the body after that.
It's actually quite amazing the difference between a live body, a living body that has a soul in it, and in one moment, it turns to wood, just like wood. It's lifeless. And it's obvious. It's obvious. Did you have a similar experience? Was it obvious?
Yeah, like body turns very pale, just in a moment, just like change of colour.
Yeah.
Very pale.
And it's just, the person isn't there anymore. It's quite amazing. So we tend to ascribe the consciousness as coming from the body, and the person is the body, but actually the person has nothing to do with the body. Or what did you do the moment that person, when the soul left, what did you do?
Just shocked initially, just sort of sudden, then surprised.
You were very surprised. Did you cry?
Yeah.
Usually, did you cry? No. Because the person is gone. But if the person is the body, which we usually think, then why do we tend to cry? Or get shocked? Because the body is there. But the fact is that we know that the person is no longer present. And that transformation is called death. So the actual condition of the body has nothing to do with the soul. We say a dead body, but is there such a thing as a live body? No, the life doesn't have anything to do with the body, it has to do with the soul. This simple, most basic ABC philosophical point is absent in the world, practically speaking. And therefore, Prabhupada was so interested in book distribution, because he said it was distribution of knowledge. Just think of how the world would change if this knowledge that the eternal soul is me. I am an eternal soul. And I'm temporarily within a body. The world would change if this was the common knowledge. There are so many hatreds and wars that take place because this group hates that group. Or this group is repressed by that group or something, or exploited. But how the world would change if everyone actually accepted, understood and accepted that we are eternal souls and we are temporarily in a body. And that the body must die, will die, and I'll go and live in another body after that. And if I'm thinking about these people that I dislike so strongly, I'm going to take my next birth in that body. Quite amazing. And in fact, the Bhagavatam describes that the meditation caused by anger and enmity with someone is even deeper and stronger than meditation caused by affection. So if I really, really hate this person, I'm going to become exactly like that person because of the absorption of the consciousness in that person and its characteristics. So this philosophical, put that away. Who wants to be shot with a cannon? You should design a camera called a rose petal. That would make it easier. So then the question comes, well, why am I in a material body? And what is this power that forces me to identify with this body so intensely, with my body, and I fully feel myself the body tending in that way? What is the cause of that? So the purport continues. Although such designations certainly apply to the body, they do not apply to the spirit soul, which is described here as para, or a transcendental entity. As long as the bewildered spirit soul remains inimical to the Supreme Personality of Godhead, the designations of the gross and subtle bodies will wrap themselves around him, keeping him in darkness. If one intellectually identifies oneself with various materialistic philosophies of life, he becomes covered by the subtle mind. Ultimately, everything that exists is part and parcel of the Absolute Truth, Lord Krishna. When the living entity realizes this, he becomes nirupadi, or free from material designations, and this is his constitutional position. Om Yanatimananda Shantanatana Salakara Saksu Samiratam Zainatas Mai Sri Lavanayama Sri Chaitanya Manavistam Stapitam Deya Utale Sayamantaramayam Vedati Svapanatikam Ramjiko Patibhisa Kripasimadayam Chanam Patitam Pahantikam. So we are not our body. We are not our body. We are not our body, nor are we anybody else's body. We hear this philosophical point again and again and again and again and again. And even Krishna in the 11th canto of the Bhagavatam is explaining this point. Why? Because it is so essential. It is the foundational point upon which the philosophy of Krishna consciousness is built. And on the other hand, the illusory energy, Krishna's Maya Shakti, is so powerful, that despite our hearing the philosophy again and again, we tend to fully identify with our bodies, gross and subtle. So the cure for that, as we had been explaining previously, is turning towards Krishna. And the methodology of the cure is called devotional service. We should turn to Krishna. We should take shelter of Krishna. If we take shelter of our bodies and identify with our bodies, what is our ultimate fate? Such disturbance. When we're young, we'd like to identify with our body. Because, why? Because the body is really the source of pleasure for us. We want to enjoy ourselves. This is the source of our enjoyment. And this is the great challenge of being young, actually speaking, is to not fall into the trap. All the bodily senses are so strong, and the tendency to enjoy that body is so strong, to not fall victim and just enjoy. Because if we place within our consciousness these impressions of sensual enjoyment, they're so difficult to remove later on. And they plague us. They plague us. They give us so much trouble. So if we can, at each different age, has a different challenge in that way. And the purpose of the non-identification of the body and non-identification of the mind, and to develop the intellect and the spiritual, with spiritual knowledge, is so that we can turn towards Krishna. And again, that turning towards Krishna is the object or the goal or the primary goal of bhakti, of devotional service. But then we turn towards Krishna. Then what do we do? With what mood do we turn towards Krishna? When we turn towards Krishna, when you turn away from someone, practically speaking, you cannot see them. When you turn towards someone, you can't see them. And when you are always turned towards someone, you can always see that person. And that is the basic primary goal that's even hinted at here. That we should always see Krishna. We should be so turned towards Krishna that we see him continuously. Tatsyaham sulabhapartam niti nitya yuktasya yogina. That for one who sees me everywhere and sees everything in me, tasyam sulava, such a person easily obtains me. I'm easy to obtain, Krishna says. Because he's constantly engaged in yoga. Yoga means connection. So he's constantly, such a person who sees me always and everywhere, is constantly connected to me. Because the connection is one of consciousness, because he's seeing Krishna, he's thinking of Krishna, he's always thinking of Krishna. In what mood, if he is to be a devotee, what mood is he always thinking of Krishna in? Primarily, it's one of being a servant. Oh Krishna, how can I serve you? What does it take to always think in that way? What can I do for your pleasure now? What does it take?
Surrender.
Surrender. Yeah. It's a little more basic than that. What does it take? And why is it difficult to always think like that? It takes faith, yes, definitely. It takes love, that's up there. I'm thinking of something else, a different word. Cooking, huh? Excuse me?
Intensity.
Yes, it will certainly take intensity. But intensity of what?
Desire.
And okay, I'll just tell you instead of the word I'm thinking of. It takes complete sincerity, full sincerity, to always be thinking, how can I please you, Krishna? It takes love, it takes commitment, it takes intensity, it takes desire, it takes full sincerity. And what is the difficulty of always thinking in that way, Krishna, how can I please you? How in this circumstance that I'm in right now, in this circumstance, I'm thinking, usually I'm thinking of myself as the center of my activities, and usually that feeling of self is imposed upon my body. But now, Krishna, I want to turn to you. How can I please you? What stops us from always thinking in that way? If using what I said, sincerity causes us. Sincerity of what? Sincerely wanting to be a devotee. And what causes us not to do that? There is insincerity. And this... Well, that's... Yeah, we're not quite sure. Yes, Krishna. There's one of the main saints of the Catholic Church, when his mother was a Christian, Saint Augustine, and he was very intelligent, didn't want to have anything to do with the sentimentality of it. And then finally he met some philosophical people who were Christian, and then he became a Christian, and he began to pray that, "Please take me, O Lord, but because I have a girlfriend, not quite yet." So we can laugh at this, but we all have something that makes us not quite yet, or not all of us, but so to speak, for all of us.
Yes,
and the multi-branches, Bahushaka, our multi-branch intelligence and nature is looking for other things to give us pleasure other than the service, being a humble servant. And this is, it has to be said, is insincerity. So what to do about insincerity? What do I do about my own insincerity? The obvious answer is become sincere. But what do I do? And Prabhupada answered that question. You know where he answered it? In Melbourne. That's not what he said at that particular time. A devotee acts, it was in the Melbourne Town Hall, 1974, and someone asked the question, "How do you become sincere?" And Prabhupada answered it first in a funny way. He said, "How do you become a drunkard?" I'm not going to tell you how to do this. But how do you become a computer nerd? All you have to do is associate with people whose whole life is connected with silicon. And you become one, because according to who we associate with, our desires become inflamed in that way. So Prabhupada answered the question, how do you become a drunkard, by saying just associate with people who love that drunken party life. The power of association is everything. It is everything. And therefore, if we wish to become sincere, Prabhupada then he said, if you want to be sincere, then he said, first, how do you become a drunkard? Then he answered the question, you associate with drunkards. And if you want to become a sincere, and then he pointed to the devotees and said, associate with them. Just imagine what you would have felt like if Prabhupada did that to you. It's me who has to be the sincere one, that I'm going to give everyone my associate, and they're going to become sincere by associating with me. How about someone else? I'm going to be the one who has to be pure and sincere. It's actually quite heavy. But if we want the result of sincerity, the result of sincerity is turning to Krishna and going back home, back to Godhead, to be with Krishna, to serve Krishna eternally, then we have to be fully sincere. And we have to be always thinking in terms of what can I do to please Krishna. It may be comfortable to me, it may be uncomfortable to me, I may like to do it, it may be with my nature, it may be against my nature, it may be hard, it may be easy, but sincere means that I do it for the pleasure of Krishna. So what happens, what tends to happen, as we begin, when we first start chanting, we are very, very sincere. And then, as we go on, we realize, maybe I'm not so sincere. And then, perhaps, we realize, maybe I'm insincere, that I'm keeping myself as the center, and I'm not actually interested in pleasing anyone but myself. And then what do? Well, we could take up different practices, or go, oh, I'm not sincere, I go away. Or we should become sincere, and by good association, by taking to the process fully of sadhana bhakti, rising early, chanting Hare Krishna, following the principles, in good association, hearing Srimad Bhagavatam. So what is it that supports our insincerity and makes us, keeps us from going forward strongly? This is a question I would like to bring up at this point. What is it that holds us back? Okay, material desires. Very often, it's material. The senses want a particular type of engagement. They want to enjoy. But Prabhupada would usually say in answer to something like that, but in Krishna consciousness there is real enjoyment. Because with the eyes we can see the beauty of Radha Balabha, and our eyes actually can become satisfied. We can taste. What can we taste and become satisfied? What is your favorite prasadam? You can reveal it, because we're amongst friends.
Garanga potatoes.
You can taste garanga potatoes and become fully satisfied with the sense of tongue. And we can hear sweet kirtans with the kirtans not too loud in our ears. Melodious devotional singing that touches the heart, etc. We can smell the fragrance, that's how Prabhupada would say that actually we can satisfy our desires. Everyone is looking for a relationship that's fully satisfying, and we are told that we should turn to Krishna and develop a relationship with him that will fully satisfy us, actually satisfy us. But do we believe that? That we can actually become fully satisfied in relationship to Krishna? Is that our experience? We should ask ourselves. And then we can become humble or we can become angry, depending upon how deep we are. We can become humble and approach Krishna and offer fine prayers to him. What holds us back? Desires?
I think it's our ego, most times, which is...
What do you mean by ego?
When we start thinking that, no, my judgment is, you know, better than what the Shastras are telling us at times, or when... Basically, you know, like, our knowledge supersedes, you know, when I becomes more powerful than him. And that's what at times we think, and
we think that what, you know, my perception is the strongest, and my judgment, and I am so wonderful, and etc.
That kind of
So big, powerful, false ego.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
So, and obviously, if we think about it using our intelligence, using Shastra, we know that this type of thinking is truly foolish. Because we all know we've made so many mistakes and got ourselves into trouble. And we know that we are not perfect, and our mind tricks us so many times. So we know that. And we know that if I think I'm so wonderful, then I'm still going to die. And if I think I'm the most wonderful, how could be? What could be more foolish than that? But this is the nature of false ego. But it's not, doesn't make any sense actually. But we can argue with that one too. We should argue. We should dispute the desires of the mind. What's another type of a thing that keeps us from asking what will please Krishna all the time? Aparadha, that's really, that keeps us. Therefore, in Chaitanya Bhagavad, tens and tens of times the message of the teachings of Vrindavan Das Thakura is avoid offending the Vaishnavas. Avoid offending the Vaishnavas. Big ones, little ones, according to our calculation. Notice that, you remember in the pastime of Dhruva Raj, that there's this really interesting little point that I remember noting it for the first time, practically speaking, and when we were at the retreat at the farm, is that Dhruva's mother, hearing what Saruchi said to Dhruva, Dhruva's mother felt like she was burning in a forest fire out of her distress, and then the person who spoke that, Saruchi, she ended up burning in a forest fire because of offending Dhruva in that way. But what is so intriguing in one sense about that, Dhruva was a great devotee because he turned so strongly to Krishna, but his desire was all material. He wasn't a pure devotee, but he was a devotee, but he wasn't a pure devotee. And yet the reaction for that was so heavy that the person who spoke so cruelly to Dhruva had her own son die due to this offense. And she herself was burnt in a forest fire. And Dhruva, who she offended, wasn't the pure devotee at that time. So we may see that this person has this fault, and this person has this fault, and this person is materialistic, and he's asking in for himself, and he's doing this for himself. We may see like that, but do we see the future? How Krishna is going to deal with them? And what happens if they become a pure devotee, like Dhruva became a pure devotee, and we've just become so angry at them and said harsh words to them, then what will happen? So Aparadha is really, and Srila Jiva Goswami in Bhakti Sundarbhi says, we chant Hare Krishna, and the only cause, he says it once, but I said it three times. The only cause for our not getting the result is Aparadha, offense. And he gives different results that come from having committed Aparadha. One is an inability to follow the sadhana. Another is crookedness in dealings. Oops. It's crookedness, hypocrisy, basically. Another?
Envy.
Huh?
Envy.
You have read it?
Envy.
Did you read it?
No.
Then how do you know? And there were five of them, and when I read that, I saw that I had an attachment to things that were not suitable for a devotee. When I read those five, I saw that I had each and every one of them. And to make it still worse, these aparadhas, it's not like, you know, it's not like you get your hand slapped and it's over. No, they can continue life after life. So it's very, very heavy. So therefore, Chaitanya Bhagavan, Vrindavan Das Thakura, says so many times, don't offend the devotees, don't offend the Vaishnavas, don't offend the Vaishnavas. Even Mother Sachi, you know, that pastime where Mahaprabhu was in a mood of giving everyone, whatever they wanted. Give this one love of God. Give this one prema bhakti. Give this one. And then one of the devotees said, give Mother Sachi, your own mother, prema bhakti. And Mahaprabhu said, no. Why? Because he has committed an offense against the Advaita Charya. And the offense was very minor, it was just barely escaped from the mouth. But she was thinking badly about him because her son, Vishwarupa, had taken sannyas. And she thought it was due to the association. He had left home due to the association of Advaita Charya. And then when Mahaprabhu, little baby Nimai, practically her only boy, and Jagannath Mishra wasn't even in this world, her husband, her Prabhu wasn't in this world anymore, and all she had was Nimai. And Nimai started associating with Advaita Charya, and then she became afraid. And she criticized him very, very slightly. And because of that, and it was very slight, she criticized the Dr. Charya. Mahaprabhu said, no, I will not give her. And the only way that she can get free from the offense is to touch the Dr. Charya's lotus feet and beg forgiveness to touch his feet. And then, so the devotees told the Dr. Charya that you're going to have to let Sachi Devi touch your lotus feet. And he said, how is that possible? She's the mother of the Supreme Lord. She is the Ganga herself. She is the universal mother. And he just started glorifying and glorifying Sachi Devi until he fell down and fainted in ecstasy. And then the devotee brought Sachi Devi over quickly and touched his feet while he was unconscious. And then Mahaprabhu said, now I'll give it to her. So he was using Sachi Devi, his own mother, to make this point. The aparad really does. And this is the difficulty, of course, in living so closely with devotees. Because familiarity tends to breed contempt. It really does, in taking everyone for granted and seeing all the insincerities, etc. Thank you for a good sneeze at the right time. Confirming these points. Sometimes Prabhupada, he'd be walking into a room or something, and if you sneeze, especially when you're in the doorway, walking to a room, it's supposed to be inauspicious. Is that it? You know that one? Do you know that one? Do you know that one? No, we didn't learn that. Our mom never taught us that one. In South India, the same? No. Prabhupada sometimes would not walk in. You would wait some second. Well, how long do you have to wait? There was a time. So what else keeps us back? That feeds our insincerities, feeds our not wanting to think of what will please Krishna.
And the realization that we think that we've gone to Krishna and that there is nothing but creative and power and we give up all our knowledge and all the
attachment. Yeah, we think that if I give up all my knowledge, there won't be anything left. Ooh, I won't be there anymore. That actually is. That Devahuti basically expresses that same doubt. In what canto? Huh? Yeah. Third canto. And Prabhupada in his purport, he says that's sort of a Buddhistic type of philosophy. But yeah, we're unsure. We don't have a real experience of who we are. Yeah. Yeah, anyone else? Could it be that we lack faith also, that Krishna will actually take care of us? If I give myself to him, will he take care of us? Will he take care of me? Will Krishna actually take care of me? Is it just philosophy, or will he actually take care of me? Sometimes we lack a little bit of faith in that too. What's the cure for that? One cure is written in that of devotion, Bhakti Sampasindhu, that one should hear Shastra in the association of devotees, that increases faith. But what else?
Mercy.
Who should we pray to for His mercy? So we can be more sincere, so we can be more what else can we do to increase our trust in Krishna? That He will take care of us.
Look at those ones who have given up and they are being taken care of.
See the example of those who are more surrendered and prove themselves more faithful than us. And it hurts faith when we see someone like that having difficulty, yes? We become afraid more. But ultimately, at the time of death, how much we have ability we have gathered to have faith that, yes, I'm in the hands of Krishna now. Because we won't be able to look towards anyone else. We won't be able to do anything. Because then we're practically we're on our own. So, but we should know that the timer, the hourglass of our life is running out. So we have to gather our own experience. Was Krishna really there or not? He's known as Bhakta Vatsala, he's known as Bhavagrahi Janardana. Well, is it really true, or is it just some story, or, well, is it really true? And if we say yes, it's true, then we should try to do something for Krishna's pleasure. We should perform some austerities for His pleasure and see if we survive. We should go and distribute books or something like that, and we should go and do some service for Krishna and see if He indeed protects us or not. If he's really there. What do you think about that methodology? How many of you have ever done a lot of sankirtan, meaning, or a lot of preaching? I know in this book this you should preach. It's a silly question to ask because we won't think that we've done really a lot or something like that. But who raise your hand if you've been in a situation where Krishna protected you? You felt that actually Krishna protected you. No one wants to feel so. You have. You have, really. When?
So many times.
So when we experience that Krishna's there and He protects us, then we're willing to take risks on His behalf and do something we wouldn't normally do for anyone else but for Krishna. And then based on that, when we see that how Krishna reciprocates with His devotees, even though I may not even be a devotee, but I'm just a faith shadow devotee, but still He takes such care of me. Just imagine how He reciprocates with those who really do give everything to Him in love. And that's what amazed Dhruva. That's what amazed Dhruva Maharaj. If Krishna is so kind that he came to me, and I was just a materialist, but I went to him, just imagine, how can he possibly reciprocate with the residents of Vrindavan, who have no other thought, no other desire, no other consideration other than the pleasure of Krishna. If he's shown himself to me out of his causeless mercy, and I'm just a materialist, how is he going to reciprocate with the residents of Vrindavan? And the answer, Lord Brahma concluded, was that he can't. He's so kind, he's kamvada saranam brajema ho pakayam stana kalabhutam likhamsya yad yabhivad svadvi lebhei. Give the position of dakti, of a nurse in the spiritual world, to Putana, who came to kill you, but looked like a devotee as a trick. But how are you going to reciprocate? And I see that you take care of me, and I'm trying to do something in my own faulty way. And then we hear that he remains forever in the den. He can't reciprocate with the residents of Vrindavan, with the Braja Gopis, or any of the residents of Vrindavan. They have captured him. The older gopis, they clap their hands. And you say, Nacho, Nacho, Nacho. And Krishna dances just to please them. He's the all-powerful Supreme Lord, and he's captured by their loving Shuddha Vatsalya Prema, their loving devotional mood. He's completely captured and controlled. He becomes controlled by his devotees. He can't reciprocate. He sells himself. He becomes the chariot driver of Arjuna. The servant of his devotee, because of his devotee's friendship, his loving friendship with him. Will Krishna take care of me? If I take a step towards him? Okay, maybe I can't up here now. Maybe I don't have the capacity to go like that. But let me take a continuum. Let me take one step towards him. That's a good way to end here, because it's 9 o'clock. Does everyone just think of what step they could actually practically take towards Krishna? Because we've heard that if we take a step to Krishna, he reciprocates. Well, what step can I take towards Krishna? Towards acting for his pleasure. I'm not going to ask you what it is, but think, what could I do that would be pleasing to Krishna instead of... I know what you can do. You can sit so nicely and fold your hands and listen in class. And you're so good at that. You're an expert at sitting nicely and peacefully here. You're in the temple. Very good. What can I do that would be pleasing to Krishna? How can I please Krishna? And Prabhupada said, this is the only question I ever asked my spiritual master. How can I serve him? Isn't that amazing? I mean, not that we can't ask other questions, but Prabhupada said, that's the only question I ever asked my spiritual master. How can I serve you? Who is the center of that question?
You.
You. How can I bring some pleasure to you? And his pleasure, what was the pleasure of Srila Bhakti Samanta Saraswati Thakur, was similarly, how can I, his mood was, how can I increase the service of Mahaprabhu. And one of the last things that Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur has recorded saying within this world was, I wish that, and Prabhupada used to quote this and rephrasing it a little, he said, I wish that every tender-hearted member of the Gaudiya Math should be willing to shed 200 gallons of blood to save a conditioned soul. One conditioned soul. In other words, blood is life. How many gallons of blood does liters or what does a human being have in his body, approximately?
5 liters.
About 5 liters.
Oh, yes, Mataji. That hurts too. 5 liters. And he said 200 gallons. That means again and again and again and again and again. After the body rejuvenates, go out again. How? In other words, no selfishness. And then Krishna sees that. This morning I heard Prabhupada say, don't try and see Krishna. Just act in such a way that Krishna will see you. And we can all do something. And it doesn't have to be big. Just something that will be pleasing to Krishna. And this is in our interest to keep this mentality of trying to do something for Krishna's pleasure and taking our baby steps towards Him. You're hiding your hands. You're sitting so nicely. Yes. Let's see. Can you sit like that too? Can you? Yeah. So nice. Okay, thank you very much. Okay, the work day. Srimad Bhagavatam ki jai, Srila Prabhupada ki jai, Sisi Radha Balava Nittai Gaur Jagannath Baladev Subhadra Devi ki jai, Gaur Bhakta Vindiki, Srila Prabhupada.
Guru
Jai.